I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of January. According to studies done by our guest, there is a severe underrepresentation of both women and people of color at all levels of elected government. Why is the question of this hour? Our guest has found, and this is a study done by the Reflective Democracy Campaign, that white males make up 31% of the population, but they account for 65% of the people who are elected to county, state, or national office in America in 2012 and 2014. All told, the study found 90% of candidates are white, 73% are men, and we'll be looking at the disparities here, how our elected officials don't reflect the makeup of our population, and find out what's going on in the state of Wisconsin and other states this hour with Brenda Charisi Carter. Brenda is the new campaign director for the Women's Donor Network. They have an initiative on creating a reflective democracy, one where our country's leaders reflect the populations they serve. Her PhD is in American Studies from Yale University. She worked for the Union of Hospitality Workers in the U.S. and Canada. She teaches courses on work, culture, and the economy at Brown University and is currently working on a book about representations of workers in contemporary American mass culture. We welcome phone calls always during our discussions, and here's how you reach us. Why do you think there is a severe underrepresentation of both women and people of color at all levels of elected government? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, our Facebook page where we love to hear from you, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at @KDunnShow. Hi, Brenda. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You did a really exhaustive examination of the 2012 and 2014 November general elections. Tell me your findings.
Right. Well, this is the first time that this data on the demographics of who runs for and holds office in the U.S. has ever been collected. So we're really proud of this, and we feel like we now have a benchmark where we sort of know where we are as a country on this, and we can measure, we hope, progress moving forward. But we found that women and people of color are really across the board absent in huge numbers from elected office. We looked at all elected offices in the country from the county level up to the president. And as you mentioned just a minute ago, we found that 90% of the people on our ballots and in office are white, over 70% are men, and 65% are white men. So two out of every three names on a ballot belongs to a white man, and two out of every three people in elected office right now is also a white man. So these were really profound, and I have to say to myself, for myself even, pretty surprising disparities. Mm-hmm.
Did you find that there was any difference in the percentages if you were looking at high national office compared to local office, Brenda?
We did find some variation, although overall the story is pretty much the same. We found that women are represented at slightly higher levels, slightly higher numbers at lower levels of office. So local and state legislature. And we found that people of color are slightly more represented at the federal level and in the state legislatures also. But these are variations within a pretty narrow range. So there wasn't, you know, there was no sort of standout story to be told here about success at, you know, one particular level of office.
What about standout states? Were there any states where the numbers were different?
Well, there again, there are definitely some states where the numbers are better than others, but that's, you know, it's a kind of a low bar to be better than most of the states in the United States at this point, because the representation is so low for women and people of color across the board. So some of the states in the Midwest, in your listening area, are towards the top. Minnesota and Illinois have better levels of representation of women and people of color than the majority of states. But again, these are pretty small improvements across the board, there's really, really, as you said, a stark underrepresentation.
Mm-hmm. The organization they're working for, the Initiative on Creating a Reflective Democracy, how in the world do you go about changing all of this to having our country be one where the leaders reflect the people they serve?
Well, yes, it's a good question, and it's a big challenge. And I think our work on this campaign really starts from a point of recognizing that the American political system really was built upon exclusion from its very inception. And over hundreds of years, different groups of people, women and people of color and others, have organized and agitated and fought to win access to the political process, mostly through voting rights. But we've never really reckoned with the fact that this is a political system that was, at its beginning, a small minority of the population was even eligible to vote. Mm-hmm. So we really look at this as a systemic and very deeply rooted historical problem. Now, having said that, we also believe this is absolutely changeable, because most of the characteristics of the way that we elect people to office are not set in stone. They're a sort of accumulation of practices that have kind of accrued over time. There's a lot of variation by state and even sometimes by local jurisdictions. And I think we've never fully reckoned as a society with the question of whether having people in elected office who reflect the range of the American population is really of value to us. And if it is, then, you know, our system absolutely can be changed in lots of ways that would make that outcome much more likely.
I know your study didn't look at this issue, or maybe you did, but I'm wondering if there have been any studies that look at whether or not young people and others consider a life in the public service world as being an honorable profession. When you look at our favorability ratings for Congress, it's way, way down there. Are a lot of people just saying, I don't want to do this?
Right, right. Yeah, that's one of the things that really motivates our work, is concern that levels of disengagement with the political process, right, as you say, are really at an all-time high. Right, people, Congress's approval ratings are all-time low. Voter turnout in 2014 was the lowest since World War II. And lots of people, particularly I think people under 40, will say that the system is really broken and not something they want to participate in.
What would the country look like in terms of the issues that we would be dealing with if we had our leaders reflect our demographics?
Well, you know, in some ways we can only speculate, because we've never had that reality.
Right.
But I think there is a lot of evidence from other countries and even from some of our states and localities where representation is more reflective to point to, I think, more responsive governance, issues that affect a wider range of people actually being taken seriously and dealt with. Legislatively and in policy. And I think for us what that points to is that there's no substitute in political leadership. There's really no substitute for lived experience. And what we have right now in our political system is the lived experience of one demographic group wildly overrepresented in the halls of power and in decision-making chambers. And I think we're really missing out on a much wider range of talent and experience that exists among the American people, among women, among people of color, whose day-to-day lives are varied in ways that I think is really important for us to understand and to capture when we're thinking about how we want to govern our community.
Mm-hmm. There certainly have been attempts, I would think, Brenda, to get women and minorities in this country to run for office. Aren't there, haven't there been such attempts that were perhaps successful for a little while?
Absolutely, and lots of people are working on this. And we have made strides, absolutely, no doubt about it. But I think What the numbers show is that we've also plateaued over the last decade or so in levels of representation of both women and people of color. So women, for instance, at no level of elected office do women constitute more than a third, or have they even broken the one-third level of representation. And I think, you know, what it, again, it for us, it reinforces the view that this is really a systemic problem and that we have to change the structures of governance. We have to change how we elect people for office. We have to change how we select and recruit the people who are on our ballots, because no amount of personal effort and or even collective effort can really achieve equality in these positions unless we also have the kind of structural change to go along with it.
How do we select people who are on our ballots?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's really, for the most part, a pretty invisible process. You know, sometimes we might hear about the invisible primary that's happening in a race, which is one way of thinking about it. But first, you know, you really have to have the economic situation that enables you to take time off to run for office.
Yes.
And then to have a source of income, in most cases, that doesn't require you to work full-time. Most elected offices don't pay enough to support a family. So you end up with a lot of people in elected office who have, who in some cases are independently wealthy or who have flexible, well-compensated work that enables them to do the work of holding their elected office at the same time. So it's very difficult to imagine, for example, a teacher or a nurse being able to hold a state legislative seat, for example. The schedules and the demands of those jobs are simply incompatible.
Mm-hmm.
So right there you weed out a huge swath of the population by that sort of economic requirement. Then there's the whole question of the cost of campaigns, which
yes.
we're all, unfortunately, all too familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But then even beyond that, even if you were to able to clear those two barriers, there's the really critical role of what we like to call political gatekeepers in this process. So that's usually the leadership of the political parties, big political donors, and other organizations that have a lot of influence in the political space, in choosing candidates, in making endorsements, and in providing funds to run campaigns. And that network is pretty informal. It's often, as I said, pretty invisible. And most people, if they want to get their name on a ballot to even have a shot at running, have to get through that selection process. And what we've found is that those gatekeeper networks, really, they're kind of, they're entrenched. They often are dominated by white men themselves. And so when they're looking for people to support for political office, they tend to choose people from their own networks, and they tend to choose people who are a lot like themselves demographically. So even when there's no necessary intention to exclude women and people of color, the kind of default choices that get made at that stage in the political process lead to ballots, as we found in our most recent study, where women and people of color are really, really absent. So, again, two of every three names on a ballot belongs to a white man.
We have a caller who wants to talk about big money in politics. We'll take that call and welcome more. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A really large underrepresentation of women and people of color at all levels of elected government. Why is that the case? Our guest this hour with the Women's Donor Network and has been very active in putting together a study that was released recently by the Reflective Democracy Campaign that looks at tens of thousands of people running for office at all levels in 2012 and 2014 and finds that most of the candidates were white, most of the candidates were male, and most of the candidates were people who fit demographic that has been in power in this country for a long period of time. So why does that continue to happen? What are the reasons that people of color, that women are not running for office as much, and why is that? And what can be done about it? That's what we're talking about this hour. Barbara in Fond du Lac, our first caller for you, Brenda. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just listening, and I was thinking, I watched an interview with Jane Mayer, who just wrote a new book. I believe it's Dark Money
on the Koch brothers.
About, yeah, mm-hmm. And I got interested in kind of the whole thing. My father was in government; he was a town chairman and in local government as I was growing up. And I always thought that would be a great goal. And as I got older and of the age where I could possibly do something in that way. Run for an office of some type, I just thought it's not the same as when he was in office. It seems like, and I don't want to just use the old Pat phrase rigged, but it seems as though there's a certain segment that you're backed by a certain group of people, or you're not, and you're really bucking uphill or upstream if you're trying to break through that. It just appears that there's so much money out there, and if you don't have access to the money, you may have a voice and a great platform and something great to say. And that's why I think everybody's rallying behind Bernie Sanders right now, because he's kind of an underdog, and he has such a wonderful message and speaks to so many people who feel voiceless right now, because we're just overwhelmed by the money and the mm-hmm. and the messages coming out of that mm-hmm. vein.
Well, they're rallying around Donald Trump as well, Barbara.
Oh yeah, a few of them are, but
right.
I mean the meat eaters. I think everybody want I. And Sarah Palin last night just helped everybody, I think. She just she did a great job.
Yeah. Brenda, your response.
Yeah, I think that, what you're saying really, it reminds us that, and this may seem sort of obvious, but, I think we can forget it because politics is sort of such a part of American life, but this is really a question of power and who has access to it. And we see the influence of corporate money and dark money, as you're saying, particularly at higher levels of office, although unfortunately that's starting to infiltrate lower levels of office too. But I think what it points to is that this is, and sort of what you're saying is, this is really a closed system, and it largely protects the people who are already in it. And if you're not already in it or connected to it in some way, and you're coming from the outside, it's pretty tough to get in.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. The new campaign director for the Women's Donor Network is our guest this hour, Brenda Therese Carter, and we're talking about their initiative, Creating a Reflective Democracy, one where our country's leaders reflect the populations that they serve. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, where if you like us, then you'll know some of the shows that are coming up. We won't bombard you with messages, but it's always good to know what we're talking about here. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. More phone calls momentarily. We're interested also in hearing from some of you who are women, people of color, who have thought perhaps about running for office and decided against it, or you did run for office, and you can talk about what a breeze it was for you or how difficult it may have been. What are the reasons that our politicians don't reflect the people who live in the country when it comes to gender, when it comes to the color of our skin? Two more phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls, and let's go to Kurt in De Pere next. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
Okay, I would guess that the political system actually reflects our economic system, where if we've got the 1% or even beyond that, probably mostly owned by white male. I mean, that's probably pretty general. But as long as that happens and money is speech, we're going to have probably that top-down kind of organization of our political system.
Brenda.
Right. Well, you know, I think it really relates to what I was saying earlier about the economic realities of running for office in the United States. So even without getting into the, as you know, as you're saying, a kind of very upper echelons of wealth in the United States to the 1%, the political system and the way that we have structured political office and access to political office absolutely excludes, as a matter of practice, excludes most of the population who simply can't afford to hold office or to run for office. So, in addition to the race and gender aspects of the demographics of political office, the class characteristics of who governs in the U.S. is something that's of real interest to us and that we hope to do more work on in the future.
Well, how many people in the Senate now, the U.S. Senate, are not millionaires? They're almost all millionaires, aren't they?
I think that's right. I think there's one or two who are not. But, you know, it's in Congress across the board, in both the House and the Senate, there are far more millionaires who hold seats in Congress than women who hold seats in Congress.
That says something, doesn't it? That statistic says something. Thank you, Kurt, very much for your call. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Yes, I remember reading 1984, and they talk about lotteries to keep the white collar. I mean, some of these people supporting Trump evidently think they could win the lottery and become a billionaire, and therefore they don't want taxes on the billionaires. But little do they know that it's easier to become a millionaire in Europe these days than it is in the United States. But I like what the ancient Greeks used to do. They randomly picked their people to represent them. I think that would throw everyone's social security number into a hat and for House of Representatives, do it that way.
Brenda, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it would be an interesting experiment for sure. But I think what you're saying is, is very much what you're suggesting is that we really need, it's worth sort of fundamentally rethinking how we select people for office and what the path to political office is. And I totally agree with that. As I was saying earlier, we have a system that we've sort of let kind of take shape over a couple of centuries, and it's really varied by state and by local jurisdiction. And if one of our goals is to have elected office holders who reflect the population, we're definitely not succeeding. So I think it's worth really rethinking the way the process happens.
Mm-hmm. Do you think at all about term limits? Is that an answer to this, to get a fresh group of talented people to go into office? Because so many of these people are incumbents.
Yeah, I think a lot of, there was a lot of hope when term limits first sort of started being used that it would open up seats, particularly for women. I think advocates for women in office were really hopeful about that. And it seems like for a while it did, but then, those same people ended up being term limited out of office and not necessarily being replaced by other women. So I think that the problem goes deeper than that. I think term limits can be helpful, but it's one piece of a few different pieces that are creating this problem. I think we have to look at all of them.
Brenda, have you ever thought about running for office?
Myself?
Yes.
Well, when I was younger, I think I did. I was, I grew up in Minnesota, and my first election was, I worked for Paul Wellstone's campaign.
Oh.
And I was a delegate to the Democratic State Convention.
Yeah.
But then, my life sort of moved on in other areas. So I can't say that I've ever seriously considered it.
But maybe you will now after you've done all this research, right?
Right. Well, I think the economic situation of my life would need to change, and I'd have to bust through the gatekeeper networks in order to make that happen.
We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. We're looking at a very interesting study done by our guest's organization that looked at a lot of data from the 2012 and 2014 November general elections, 60,285 candidates who appeared on voters' ballots, and they identified the race and gender of 51,281 candidates. It closely mirrored that of elected officials in general. 89.8% of candidates identified were white, 71.6% were male, 65.7% were white males. That's who runs in America. That's who rules in America. And the question is, why is that the case? And how society might benefit from a more reflective democracy? Brenda Charisi Carter is our guest, new campaign director for the Women's Donor Network's initiative on creating a reflective democracy. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This email came in similar to some of the comments that have been made this hour so far. Like any other business, the majority of the people who run things are white men because they make the money and they work in the power positions. Change this and the balance would change.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think what's helpful about understanding that is that, you know, we have a sort of myth in the United States that's pretty powerful, that, you know, anybody can run for office and it's just kind of an open field and you put your name on a ballot and then the voters choose. And that's a great myth and it's a very powerful and kind of uplifting democratic story, but in fact is really not true. There's, as we've been discussing, an extremely powerful and most often hidden system that determines in reality who can have access to these positions. So the political landscape is not just an open field of access. It's like almost every other area of American life, which is that it's structured to protect the group of people who are already in it, and access to it is guarded by people who take that job very seriously.
Josie in Sheboygan. Hi, Josie.
Hi.
Hi.
Gosh, I have so much to say, but she mentioned Paul Wellstone. He was such a wonderful person. It was such a tragic thing that happened to him, and I think his wife and daughter were killed also in a plane crash. And I was also going to say that President Abraham Lincoln couldn't be elected today under these circumstances. It's just so corrupt. The U.S. has no moral authority as far as, the election, the corruption in the election. I mean, it's just so overwhelming. You know, like in England, they take, a few months to elect their people. And I prefer, frankly, their way, their parliament way of doing laws and all that, then the way we do it here, it takes forever. And like everybody knows, we're tethered to these corporations. You know, bribery, I heard somebody say this was wonderful, that bribery has always existed, but Citizens United, the Supreme Court made it absolutely legal. So where do you go? It's just unbelievable that, you know, we probably should have millions of people out in the street protesting, because nothing is going to change as long as you have people that are, like your guest says, entrenched, and they're millionaires. Even if they're thousandaires, when they go into government, they come out millionaires, and then they make more money as lobbyists or whatever crooked way of doing business, you know, in the U.S. It's just, I'm a senior citizen, and I do not see anything getting better. I just don't.
Thank you. Brenda, do you share that pessimism?
I don't, actually. I share the sense that this is, that we do have a growing crisis on our hands, a crisis of political engagement and political legitimacy. I think that's true. But I think that, you know, I think that these changes are possible. And if there's one thing that American history shows, it's that organized and energetic groups of people who want to change the system can do that. So I'm not hopeless about this, but I do think the urgency that the caller feels about this, and that I think a lot of us feel about the state of the democratic process in the United States, is absolutely correct.
Mm. So what is the strategy if you were addressing a group of high school students in Milwaukee, Wisconsin this afternoon, Brenda, to get some of them to think about public service, running for office as a career path for them, and you were particularly interested in addressing the women and minorities in your audience, what would you say?
Well, I would say, first of all, that just like gaining access to any other position of importance or position of power, it's not likely that you're going to be invited in. You're going to have to fight your way in. But that is an absolutely worthwhile thing to do. I would say I would encourage them to look at the political offices in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, and figure out who holds them. How much do those positions pay, and what does that mean for who is likely to be able to hold those positions and who isn't? I would ask them to look at the demographics of the people in the Wisconsin State Legislature, in the Milwaukee City Council, in Wisconsin's congressional delegation, and at the statewide level. And I would encourage them to get involved in politics at a very as soon as they can. And to become active in whatever their political party or other political organizations might be, and push for change in those organizations. You know, the political parties in particular have such a role to play in this, and in places where the parties have decided to prioritize reflective representation and getting candidates on the ballot who look like the communities they would represent, they've been successful in many places. I think when they have chosen not to do that, we see the numbers, you know, we see the results in the numbers that we have today. So there's lots of room to move here, and I think that increasingly the political parties, out of sheer self-interest, are going to recognize that recruiting and supporting candidates who reflect the American people is what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that they will be slower to recognize that than I might like, and that a number of us might like. But if particularly if they're pushed from within and from by voters and by local party activists and people who are interested in politics, this is a change that will happen.
And the demographics are changing. Pretty soon this country is not going to look like anything that was around, 50 years ago. And it would seem to me as though that really necessitates a change in who governs us.
Right. I think so. And, I think there's a way that we can we can view that as a difficult thing, as a kind of brewing crisis. And in some places it is. We've seen, places like Ferguson, Missouri, where the demographics of the community are not reflected in political office. We see how the system breaks down. I think that's one possible future for us as a country. I think there's another really much more positive future for us that's equally available to us, which is that we have an incredibly varied population with an incredible range of talents and experiences and perspectives. And right now, I would argue that we're missing out on that by having so much political power concentrated in the hands of one demographic group. And I think if we think of this as really America living up to its democratic and inclusive promise, I think the system that we could build and the representation that we could have and that we do see in some places could be incredibly vibrant and really strong and forward-looking.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Josie, for your call. Frank in Madison, hi.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. This is Frank from Madison.
Hi, Frank.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to stand up and cheer for changing the way we vote. I think we should vote by the method of approval voting, or otherwise known as acceptance voting, where instead of running any primaries, the people on the ballot are those who can get enough people to sign a nomination petition, which, of course, has to be carefully controlled so that, you know, you don't just let people accumulate nominating signatures over years. But otherwise, you can then vote for any or all of the people on the ballot, and whoever gets the most approval votes or other acceptance votes effectively becomes the one who's elected. And in the same time, signals can be read from this as to what people like by how the also-rans scored, as to, you know, people saying, hey, I like that person too.
So how does this work? You need a certain number of people to endorse you?
Well, there's always nomination papers
right.
for this, but basically you would need enough people signing a nomination paper in a state for, actually, I guess for president, I would say have, you know, a certain number of states at least with a certain percentage of the population signing nomination papers. And, of course, you can only sign one nomination paper. You can't sign everybody's nomination paper. But that's how that I, you know, would do that. But anyway, so say in 1992, you'd have Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush and Ross Perot and Ralph Nader, and people on the left might vote for both Nader and Clinton, and folks who are very, you know, scared of people out on the wings would might say, oh, I'll vote for both Clinton and Bush, and, you know, and then maybe people who hate the middle would vote for both Nader and Perot. But in any case, you'd have, in effect, people able to choose a number of people whom they would say, I could live with that person.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, and basically, I view this as a very conservative way of electing people, and conservative in the real sense, not in the right-wing nut sense, or, you know, anything like, in effect, you would tend to get middle-of-the-road people, but you'd also get a signal as to where people, who else they liked, and what was, you know, beginning to appeal to folks. So.
Brenda, thank you, Frank. Brenda.
Yeah, I'm so glad you raised this, because it actually really points to another area of our process that we could really rethink. And, you know, when I was saying our system of selecting who's in office is sort of an accumulation of practices over time that really varies, this is probably Exhibit A in that regard. And there are lots of municipalities and jurisdictions that are experimenting with voting systems or electoral systems that are not just what the ones that we usually use, right? This kind of winner-take-all system with a primary and then a separate general election. So, and there's some early, you know, evidence to suggest that these are really positive for a number of reasons, including that they open up the system to candidates other than the usual suspects. So, for instance, the city of Minneapolis is now using ranked choice voting.
Oh, they are.
Mm-hmm, which is also happening in a number of other cities across the country. And, you know, people who have participated in ranked choice voting as candidates really say that it leads to a very different kind of campaign.
Mm-hmm.
It's often much less expensive. It's more inclusive. It doesn't encourage the kind of scorched earth campaigning that you see in the traditional one vote, winner-take-all kind of race, because you want to, if you're a candidate, it's very important to you to get the votes of voters for whom you may not be their first choice, but you might be their second,
mm-hmm.
for instance, because those votes sort of accumulate in the way that they're counted. So you don't want to be going around alienating your opponent's supporters. And it encourages a different, as I said, a different kind of campaigning and outreach to much a broader range of people rather than just what is usually thought of as, you know, a particular candidate's base. So there are innovations like that. And there are lots of different ways of thinking about this. Like, there, you know, historically the United States has different has had different kinds of congressional districts, for instance. At times, different states have had districts where there were more than one representative, so larger districts with multiple representatives. There's lots of different ways of structuring the system. And again, I think if we decided as a society that opening up the system and making access to power to a wider range of people was really a priority, there's lots that we could do along these lines in voting systems, but in all kinds of different ways, as we've been discussing, that would lead to that outcome.
Mm-hmm. Brenda Tracy Carter is our guest this hour. She directs the Reflective Democracy Campaign. It's an initiative of the Women Donors Network, and what they are trying to do is first make us aware of who's governing the country and how it does not reflect the makeup of the population in terms of women representation, in terms of minority representation. Why is that, and what can be done about it, is what we're talking about. She has an interesting background. Her PhD is in American Studies from Yale. She worked for the Union of Hospitality Workers in the U.S. and in Canada. She teaches at Brown University, and she's writing a book about representations of workers in contemporary American mass culture. She was born in Seoul, South Korea, and grew up in Minnesota. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our Facebook page, leave messages there. We love to read them. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls. Let's go to Margot in Prairie du Chien next. Hi, Margot.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm glad to... And I hope you won't mind if I call you Brenda. But I'm watching the political system, and you talk about minorities, whether they be women or whatever. Why have we forgotten our Native Americans and their voice? Where did that fall down the drain?
Brenda.
Well, that's a pretty big question. But you're right, absolutely, to point to... that group in the United States, which is more profoundly underrepresented in political office, perhaps, than any other. We actually found in our research that people in elected office, among the 42,000 people in elected office that we looked at and we were able to identify by race and gender, that only 1/3 of 1% are identified as American Indian or Alaska Native. So it's a stark, very, very stark underrepresentation for sure.
Yes, it is. Margot, thanks for your call. Ray in Milwaukee, hi.
I want to echo the lady who called in a little while ago and said she really sees things just getting worse. There's no doubt about it. Things are getting worse. We live in the Selma of the North, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is 60-70% black. Our police department is probably 70-80% white. There is a white police chief. The judges in this city, mostly white males. So it's not only in the offices, it's also in the legal system. It's all throughout our whole country. Look at the tech industry, the exact same thing, mostly white men. And I think the structure that our country was built on is broken. And if we think for a second that people who have to work on Tuesdays have a fair chance of voting, and we're not demanding weekend voting in this state, Scott Walker is trying his best to limit people going to the polls. He's cut back on early voting. They've instituted this ridiculous thing about you have to have an ID when there was zero cases of fraud. And I think the only case of fraud in the state of Wisconsin was actually a Republican who had voted in several different places. So I'd like the guests to come back in 5 years and look back on today's show. I guarantee you we are headed down unless people start marching in the streets, and maybe on voting Tuesday this coming November, instead of voting, we all go on strike and shut the whole system down, term limits. Some of these people have been in there 30 and 40 years.
All right, let's get a response. Brenda.
Well, you know, I'm really glad that you raised the issue of the legal system because one of the we haven't had a chance to talk about this yet this hour, but one of the things that we looked at a few months ago in a research project was exactly on this point. We looked at the demographics of elected prosecutors across the United States, and we wanted to look at this because of the crisis in municipalities all over the country around policing. And police violence. And we also felt that this was an elected office that if we sort of looked at the demographics of it, it would make concrete, it would help us to understand differently why the demographics of who's in office actually matters. And what we found was shocking to me, and I was prepared to be pretty surprised by the results, but we found that of the 2,400 elected prosecutors across the country, 4 out of 5 are white men. And over half of the 50 states have no elected black prosecutors. And in 14 states, all the elected prosecutors are white. So there is an even more stark disparity in elected prosecutor positions than in elected office holders across the board. And so this is a sort of window into the kind of legal system that you're describing, that you're concerned about. But I would say that in these, at least in the case of elected prosecutors, they are at least theoretically accountable to the public, right? These are positions that we do elect. So there's really an opportunity for us to make change in who holds those seats.
What about in large urban centers in this country that have greater minority populations? Is there a difference in election of prosecutors and other officials?
You know, there are definitely some exceptions to the overall pattern, but across the board, Marilyn Mosby, for instance, in Baltimore has recently gotten a lot of attention as a black woman who is overseeing the prosecution of the officers in the Freddie Gray case. So there are definitely some exceptions, but even in places where you might expect there to be prosecutors of color, they're really pretty shockingly absent.
One more call and 1 minute left. Joan in Eau Claire, hi.
Good afternoon. Your earlier caller correctly identified the corruption in our political system. No good change will happen as long as Citizens United is in effect. There is a grassroots movement to repeal Citizens United, and it's called Move to Amend. That would go a long way. We also have a Wisconsin lawsuit currently progressing by the Fair Elections Project, disputing these egregiously gerrymandered Wisconsin districts, calling for nonpartisan redrawing of district boundaries. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you for the call. Brenda, just briefly.
Yeah, I think I would say that, you know, what all the callers have expressed and that I would echo is that voters really are not the problem here. voters across the board want change. They want change in the demographics of who elects them. So we did a survey that found 3 out of 4 voters, regardless of party affiliation, support having more women and people of color in elected office. So I think there's really strong sentiment among American people to change the way that our political system works, and that actually makes me really hopeful.
Well, it's good to end on a hopeful note, Brenda, and I thank you so much for being with us and for doing the study.
It.
Good.
Thank you so much.
I'm glad. We enjoyed having you. Brenda Teresi Carter, she is the new campaign director for the Women's Donor Network. And we're talking this hour about their initiative on creating a reflective democracy. It's worth you looking at their statistics on who's running for office and the predominance of white males. Yeah, the study is the most thorough that has been done. We thank her for being with us. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Stay with us for the second hour. Very informative Scientific American article on trans youth in this country.